I'm Jim Fleming, and this is the podcast of one segment from To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas from PRI, Public Radio International, and Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'd like to hear what you think about our podcasts. To participate, just visit npr.org/research to offer your thoughts through our questionnaire.
You know, I've got to say I was surprised to hear about the title character in Salman Rushdie's new novel, Shalimar the Clown. He's not only a Muslim fanatic, but a political assassin. Let's just say I remember all too clearly what happened the last time Rushdie ran afoul of Islamic ideologues. But Rushdie's novel's not just a story about Islamic fanaticism. It's also about Kashmir, which Rushdie says was once a kind of earthly paradise. This may be hard to believe today, given the devastation caused by the recent earthquake in Pakistan and the political violence that's ravaged the region for decades. But Rushdie told Steve Paulson that Kashmir was once a magical place. Here's an excerpt from his novel.
We who live in these luxury limbos, the privileged purgatories of the earth, have set aside thoughts of paradise, yet I tell you that I have seen it and walked by its fish-rich lakes. In Kashmir, it is paradise itself that is falling. Heaven on earth is being transformed into a living hell.
That passage is so interesting because for most of us in the West, Kashmir is anything but paradise. It seems to be a prime example of a region that's been torn apart by religious and ethnic hatred. And yet, part of what you've done in this novel is to take us back to a time when Kashmir was much more peaceful. In fact, when it was almost a kind of Shangri-La.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, a part of Kashmir, one of the high valleys of Kashmir, Ladakh, was probably the model for Shangri-La in James Hilton's novel Lost Horizon a long time ago. But certainly for me and for many people in India, for a long time, in living memory, until about 20 or 30 years ago, Kashmir was this enchanted place. It was India's holiday playground. It's where people went from all over India in the hot season to go and enjoy snow and coolness. But apart from its kind of tourist values and apart from its enormous physical beauty, there was also a kind of what one might call human beauty. There was a culture that had grown up in Kashmir of harmony, broadly speaking, harmony between different religions, between primarily Hindus and Muslims, but also Sikhs and a very few Christians and Jews.
Now, I've read that you were very fond of your grandfather, who I believe lived in Kashmir, who was a devout Muslim.
Yes, he was my mother's father. He and my grandmother both were raised in Kashmir and met and married there. Subsequently, he came south out of Kashmir and practiced medicine elsewhere in India. But yeah, he was the kind of giant of my childhood and a very gentle, tolerant, open-minded, big-hearted man. One might say, in spite of the fact that he, unlike me, was a very devout Muslim and had performed the pilgrimage to Mecca and said his prayers 5 times a day and was teased by his grandchildren for his excessive devotion, as we would. And yet he was absolutely open to all kinds of discussion. There were no no-go areas. It was nothing like the radical, fanatical Islam that we hear so much about now. And he became, for me, a kind of model of how to be in the world.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say that because, of course, your public persona is someone who is very critical of at least a certain kind of Islam, radical Islam, and yet you're saying you were very influenced by this devout Muslim who happened to be your grandfather.
You know, I'm not myself religious, but it doesn't stop me being influenced by good people when I have the good fortune to be around them, especially if they're my grandfather. And I think, you know, one of the things that the book tells is that the kind of Islam that existed in Kashmir was of this kind. It was of my grandfather's kind. It was devout, yes, but it was also very lightly worn. You know, it wasn't something that people beat their fists on tables about. It wasn't menacing or threatening. It was mild, mystical, and lived in harmony with people of other religions. And that Islam was attacked from across the Pakistan border by radical jihadist groups coming in there with a quite different idea of Islam.
But what's astonishing about the story is that this all happened within about a generation or so. I mean, you're really saying that when you were growing up, Kashmir was a peaceful region, and now it's so torn apart by violence.
I mean, as recently as, I would say, even the late 1970s, the world I'm describing still substantially existed. And now, I mean, the real explosion took place in 1989. And since then, it's been, yeah, one of the world's great trouble spots. You know, Kashmiris are so famous, legendarily gentle and non-violent in India that there are jokes about it. You know, in the way that people make Polish jokes or rude jokes about communities, the rude jokes about Kashmiris were all about their lack of martial spirit and their lack of courage. So lacking in violence was the valley. It's deeply ironic that of all places, this place, which was so famous for its peacefulness, should now be so famous for its violence. The thing that happened did not happen from inside the Kashmiri people. It happened from outside. First, they were seriously oppressed by the presence of gigantic numbers of Indian soldiers who were there in order to hold the valley against what they perceived as the risk of Kashmiri, of Pakistani attack. And then they were attacked by the Pakistani-sponsored Islamic radicals. So they were caught between the rock of India and the hard place of Pakistan.
So you're saying this is not just because of the hardliners from Pakistan, that India has its share of responsibility in all of this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why one of the epigraphs to the novel is "A Plague on Both Your Houses" from Romeo and Juliet is that that's exactly what happened in Kashmir. It got squeezed between two warring powers. And what nobody ever asked the people of Kashmir is, what do they want? And they rather consistently said that what they wanted was to be left alone.
Is that still possible?
Well, the only thing to be said is that there are beginning to be more peace-like noises from both India and Pakistan. There are beginning to be conversations between the governments, and there's a rhetoric of peace. It has begun to be heard.
I've heard that actually one of the hopeful signs have been the cricket matches that Pakistan and India have played against each other.
Yeah, it's rather wonderful, actually, because it used to be that when India and Pakistan played each other at cricket, the cricket ground would become like a kind of war zone. You know, there would be so much security there in order to prevent the explosion of some kind of Indo-Pakistan violence. Now it's the opposite. Now when they have these cricket matches, they're like love-ins. You know, the people, the supporters of the two teams meet as if they were one people, which, of course, until 60 years ago, they used to be. And they each celebrate the achievements of the other team. I mean, it is kind of ludicrously nice. One could argue that cricket may be the way that India and Pakistan will finally make peace.
Now, I read one review of your book which said that the overarching theme of many of your recent novels has been a kind of quarrel with history, that you've been arguing with how history has turned out, and perhaps you yourself feel trapped by history. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, it's an interesting one. Yeah, I mean, I didn't read that review, but it sounds interesting to me. I mean, you know, the thing is that I didn't study English literature at university. I studied history. And so for me, that engagement with history has always been an important part of how I've approached writing.
So you're saying in your fiction, you feel obligated to write about politics. You cannot just deal with a sort of a private, personal world.
Yeah, I mean, when you say politics, what I don't mean is that the books have a simple polemic purpose. You know, they're not trying to make a point. I mean, Uncle Tom's Cabin, that's a political novel. It's trying to make the point that slavery is bad, and indeed was a very powerful political novel. My interest is more to try and show the way in which ordinary lives are also shaped by the great events of our time. So Shalimar the Clown, for example, the character, one of the great shaping events in his life is an entirely private event, or seemingly private, which is that his wife breaks his heart by leaving him and running off with the American ambassador, a man who he subsequently, many years later, will get his revenge on by murdering. Now, that seems like a perfectly private, if you like, a story of a crime of passion, a revenge tragedy. But as you read the book, you see that those private lives are set into the public context of tension between East and West, of what we've been discussing, of the growth of Islamic radicalism. And this is a function that literature has always performed, but I think it might be unusually important right now.
But in some ways, it didn't seem to perform that role when, well, let's say when Jane Austen was writing, even though she was writing in the heyday of the British Empire, and certainly British soldiers popped up in her stories, but she didn't get at the larger political issues.
No, she didn't. I mean, there are people who have criticized Jane Austen for that, but in my view, that's getting the wrong end of the stick. The point about the 18th century, and indeed some of the 19th century, is that it was entirely possible for Jane Austen to tell the story of her characters without involving the public sphere, because the public life did not impact on the lives of her characters. There's nothing that happens to the Bennet sisters in Pride and Prejudice that would have been improved by bringing in the Napoleonic Wars. You know, because those wars are remote from them in the place where they live, and their story can be fully told without an appeal to history. And I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, even more recently than Jane Austen, you know, Charles Dickens, arguably the greatest ever English novelist, wrote this huge shelf of novels and barely ever mentioned the British Empire, which was in those days at its height and controlling a quarter of the world. It didn't seem necessary to him to tell the stories of his people, to make reference to that. In the time between Charles Dickens and now, the world has dramatically changed, and I think that the public and the private have just got pushed much, much closer together, partly by the intervention of things like radio and television, and now, of course, the internet. We all know about each other in milliseconds, but also because, you know, owing to all kinds of different things like, you know, mass migration or globalization, and yes, you know, even things like international terrorism, the world has become a much smaller place. And I think, you know, as a novelist, I have to take cognizance of that.
Salman Rushdie. His latest novel is called Shalimar the Clown. We talked with Steve Paulson. You've been listening to a segment from PRI's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Public Radio's Peabody Award-winning magazine of ideas. If you would like to hear the program in its entirety, visit ttbook.org or find it on your local public radio station. You can also download the program through audible.com.